Good evening, and thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Amanda Vinicky. He used to be the most powerful figure in Illinois government. Today, he's a defendant in a criminal corruption trial. Jurors have heard House Speaker Michael Madigan in secret recordings.
That doesn't have to be in writing. I can just verbally tell him, look, you can go on with these boards and commissions. And I'll monitor what goes on with the boards and commissions.
Okay.
We're doing that already.
Now they're hearing from the man directly. Madigan testifies in his own defense. On his former Capitol turf, a new class of state legislators take their seats.
It might be a tough year ahead. We will face stressful moments.
Illinois has always been a state of possibilities, but one-party control has stifled that success.
Members of the 104th General Assembly, let's rise to meet this moment together.
And Mayor Brandon Johnson has a soaring wish list for Springfield.
We are working collaboratively, and we are in constant conversations with the state of Illinois, with the governor's team, with the leadership in Springfield.
Governor J.B. Pritzker tells it differently.
They don't reach out very often, and it seems like they don't have good relationships in Springfield, in part because they don't do the outreach that's necessary.
The city reopens a mental health clinic.
This ground right here has been set with foundation of helping support people who are in need.
And Chicago reaches global heights for heavy traffic. That's got leaders contemplating a congestion tax. And now to our Week in Review panel. Joining us are Ray Long from the Chicago Tribune, Shia Kapos from Politico, Michael Liptrot of Block Club Chicago, and also from Block Club, we've got Quinn Myers. Now, Ray, I'm going to begin with you because Madigan, known as one of the most taciturn politicians, and I'm going to guess all of Illinois government history.
Right.
Heck, this is another one where he could set national figures, maybe. So why did he take the stand?
Well, you know, I don't have the internal conversation with him that we would love to have, but the reality is after folks like you and I have watched him for so long, he is probably in his mind thinking he's the best person who can tell his story. And he's been on the stand and given it in a very relaxed way. He looks directly at the jurors. He talks to them in very simple phrases that are easy to understand. And he has logical explanations as his attorneys threw softball questions to him over and over. But they addressed some of the very serious issues. And he was able to come up with answers that were solid. They were believable. They sounded good. But, hey, he's got to come up against the prosecution next week, and that will be the real test.
And unlike when you and I have interviewed him in the past and gone to press conferences and he maybe relied on phrases or sort of skirted the question, he's not going to be able to do that.
Right. He is going to have to stay on the witness stand. He is not going to be able to say, okay, that's it. I'm done with answering questions. The press conference is over. He's got to stay right there, and the prosecution will not let up.
Shia, court watchers, some see this as a potentially risky move for him, maybe an indication that trial hasn't gone well, and so this is sort of a Hail Mary. How do you view it?
I thought he seemed like he knew he was the best one, like Ray said, to tell his story, and so maybe they thought it was the best way to move forward. I took it as that they thought it would be good for their case. And so far, if you're a regular person listening to him, it sounds really logical and it makes sense. I could see them, believing him on that.
You know, Michael, I want to bring you in here. We heard that Madigan say that he was shocked when former alderman Danny Solis suggested the notion of a quid pro quo. What do you make of his testimony there?
Quid pro quo has really been the word of the week, Amanda. And with this instance in the Madigan trial, to just the trial as a whole, we're seeing just the old Chicago politics and it really being brought to the forefront when it comes to thinking about that generational divide where I scratch your back, you scratch mine, has gone on for so long and people don't see anything wrong with it. And the notion of quid pro quo, seeing how different it is from when Madigan first started in politics 50 years ago to now. And with any generational divide, thinking about how the sensitivity and what we view as acceptable now. And so a lot of this is going to be dissected when it comes to the trial.
I thought the quid pro quo
quid pro quo comment was so interesting because, you know, when you listen to the recordings, it does seem like Madigan pauses and he's like, wait, what? Like, you know, you're actually saying the legal term here. You know, I think that was a shock even to him, years ago.
But it is a shock of offense. This is not what we're doing here,
no,
as he alleges. Or was
it's
a shock
of
you said it out loud.
How dare you say this out loud? That's how I interpreted it. Yeah.
That's how you interpreted it?
I did. Like, what the heck are you saying? Get in my office now.
Right.
We got to talk
say
about
this. Out loud. Exactly.
Scolding almost the yeah. child. You're supposed to know better here. You're a sitting alderman. Any indication, Ray, from the jury of how they took this? Because it is something that I watch and let's be all of you at the table. If I could help you get a job, I'd say, hey, yes, I know Michael, I know Quinn, I know Shia, I know Ray. They're great at this job. It's different though when you are the speaker and you have something to give in return, to
right.
hold something over their heads, right?
Right.
Ray? Is
right.
that something that we're seeing attorneys make the point of?
Well, I think that Madigan is posing this as like my 13th Ward headquarters was a mecca. He actually
he called
said
it that.
That. Yes. And he said we were a pillar of the community and people came in there and they, you know, needed jobs and I'd try to help them. And what's wrong with trying to help people get a job? And that's how he's setting this up. And that's how he has argued it ever since the charges have come down. So that is the approach that's being taken. And the jury is eyeing it. They're sizing him up. I got to tell you, there was a note out to the judge right before Madigan came on that said, you know, how much longer do you think we'll be going? Or, you know, do you think we're going to have to do this much longer? Then they come back out, Madigan takes a stand, and they were like, snap, too. So it was a whole different
scene.
So
the jury may be a little bit done with things, and then their attention has been rekindled.
Right, absolutely.
Something else that I wanted to touch on, because so much of this, of course, his fellow defendant is Michael McLean, longtime lobbyist, long time ago, had served in the House with the Speaker. And now Madigan says they're no longer buddies after this long-term relationship. What do you, Shia, take away from that? Because we've seen something that was shocking to me is McLean's emails are certainly very blatant. I see that as something that Madigan would be truly repulsed by. This is a guy who doesn't have a cell phone.
I think that was the case from the very beginning when we learned about those emails, knowing that Michael Madigan does not do email, does not do telephones, and here this trusted person was emailing folks. And you have to imagine when he found out, he was like, oh, like, what's happening here?
Did you read any of those?
A little bit. I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, that was what was so interesting to me about this trial this week is Madigan, we get the glimpse behind the curtain a little bit, and yeah, he does not use email, whether that be for because he wants to just log off at the end of the day or because he doesn't want a paper trail. That was actually a central point of the testimony. But I think, yeah, I think his friendship with McLean is over. But I don't think he didn't totally, shift all the blame to McLean either. I don't think he's trying to kind of, walk the fine line of just protecting himself without totally throwing him under the bus so far. We'll see what happens when the prosecution questions him this week.
When you bring up a paper trail, that's something I definitely think about in terms of if this is strategic or not, because it is believable that someone that is 82 years old does not have a phone, does not read emails for a typical 82-year-old. But someone who's been involved in politics, events, things that they have to be briefed on developing information so often, the question of is it that believable for Michael Madigan? And is he truly using this to distance himself from these emails?
Ray, last word to you because you've been in the courtroom.
Well,
and literally wrote the book on Madigan, I should add.
Well, thank you. But I think, as you know, there has always been a vibe in Springfield that don't write something down, it might hurt you. And McLean actually said that to a lobbyist who was coming on board after being a staffer and talking about how this is something that you got to be real careful about. Then they get to McLean's house, and he's got file cabinets full of stuff. It was just
I know my mom is watching, yeah. And this reminds me of what she always tells me. Do as I say, not as I do, is what she says.
Hi, Mom.
All right, well, I have to, let's move on to other parts of Springfield, obviously, where Madigan used to rule the roost. Democrats are still in charge. They still hold an iron grip. Shia, besides a shiny new Senate chamber, what was different when you were in our state capitol this week?
Well, it was supposed to be pretty dull. It was called lame duck session ahead of the inauguration. Nothing was supposed to
happen.
Could
have just called it lame session.
Lame session. And then it turned out that there was a controversial hemp bill. There was a debate in the Democratic caucus that upset the governor, and the governor and the speaker are kind of at odds over that, and there was lots of drama.
So lots of drama. Let's actually hear a clip, because the mayor is hoping for Springfield to really loosen its purse strings. But according to the governor, Brandon Johnson and the fifth floor have not done much by means of asking for that. And so we had Pritzker making the unusual move of publicly calling out Mayor Brandon Johnson for his poor relations with Springfield.
The lines of communication are open, but people have to take advantage of the open communication line, and often that didn't happen with regard to the hemp bill. Didn't call anybody in my administration. Never raised it, you know. And with regard to his budget, literally the last call that we got from them was in September, and then once in December, we by the way scheduled calls, and then they didn't show up.
Ouch, Quinn. Indeed. So putting aside the hemp itself, the sort of the material disagreement here, why would Pritzker unleash like that?
Well, the mayor for several weeks and months has been saying that he has been in regular communication with Pritzker's office, especially on revenue. The mayor really wants to see more, quote, progressive forms of revenue, like bringing back the graduated income tax, which was defeated a couple years ago. He's saying he's been in touch with Pritzker, or at least with his people have been in touch with Pritzker's people. Pritzker has basically come out and said that's not really true. We barely hear from him. And I do think some of that frustration you heard in his voice is over the hemp bill. You know, the governor did suffer a defeat on that, and he rarely suffers any defeats in Illinois. I think the governor is, you know, I was surprised to see him lash out like that, actually, because that he's had a bit of a tense relationship with Johnson since the beginning of Johnson's term, but this was by far the most public indication of that.
It was clear he made a choice.
It was clear he made a choice, because the governor is pretty good at dodging questions, I think, when he doesn't want to answer them, and he made a choice to go on the record here and go after Johnson.
You know, I asked that after Johnson appeared on WTTW Monday night saying he was in contact with the governor's office, and I kept hearing that wasn't the case, so that's how we asked the question. And
it was you that asked that question.
Yes, and those of us in the reporting crew, we were all like, wow, you know, wow, this is more than we thought we'd get today.
So it could be that he's sort of smarting over this humiliation of defeat on hemp. It could be built-up frustration. Michael, is there any sign that Johnson received this message and that it could change how he operates?
I'm not sure when it comes down to how much what Johnson says versus if it's actually going to be repaired in terms of relationship. Because we just saw where he spoke and said that he talks to Pritzker all the time. He has great relationships downstate. And then you see someone saying the opposite. So it's really going to be up to him to see whether or not he heeds this word and whether or not he takes it to heart and works to mend those relationships.
The mayor is taking the high road, at least on Tuesday when he did a whole round robin of media interviews. He did not, lash back out. He is saying, you know, we do have a working relationship. So that's his tactic, at least for now.
That's usually his tactic, too. As Amanda, you remember, he didn't really attack Madigan until Madigan was declared public official A. So he could maneuver around, and he knew that Madigan had power, and he knew he may not like everything Madigan was doing, but he still did not blast him.
So maybe a message to Johnson, or maybe, hey, he's so weak in the polls, I can do it and face no consequences. Yeah. Shia, is this going to be a harbinger of difficulty for the mayor with those loads of requests he has?
Requests for
of money for CPS. Does this not bode well? Or
well, the mayor's office did a good job of sending a team to Springfield. While Pritzker was in Normal, Illinois, with that press conference, there was a team in Springfield. So, and they were successful helping stop that hemp bill, maybe. So maybe they'll do a better job of being in Springfield more. Maybe they got the message.
They say that they're ramping up their team that will be coming to the Capitol.
Right, right.
Sticking with you for just a moment, because as you noted, it is not just Johnson that is facing the wrath of the governor. It's also a little bit the House Speaker. And you talked with Representative or Speaker Welch.
Right, right. Speaker Welch, the controversy came because Speaker Welch has a rule in the Democratic caucus that you have to have 60 votes before you send a bill to the House floor, because he doesn't want any messy arguments in public. He wants that to be done in private, you know, where all the Democrats are, behind closed doors, no media around. This time, the governor sent two people in to help talk about the bill, and the discussion got heated, and maybe it got too heated. People were upset. The governor was upset that his people went in there and might have been berated. We don't know exactly how heated it was. But anyway, people are upset. The governor was upset at Welch for letting it get to that point.
Welch, is he still upset, and what is Welch
They
say?
Haven't spoken. So they haven't spoken since, so I think that that means, but they both respect each other. Pritzker said mistakes happen. I think Pritzker's moving on. Welch says he still respects the mayor, or the governor, of course. You know,
with
he's
all
on
due
board.
Respect is one of the biggest names.
He's all on board with the governor, so I think they will be fine, but it does show that there could be some tension right as they are having to deal with this $3 billion budget shortfall. So.
Any other highlights from your speaking with the speaker?
There are people in his leadership team that are being moved around a little bit. Out is Representative Ortiz. And if you remember, at the last spring session, Ortiz left early from a vote.
And a crucial vote.
Crucial vote. He wasn't there. He was on his way home. And I don't know if that's why, but...
But yes, lots of change in House Democratic leadership, and as we know, that is a powerful position,
yes.
Hence the former speaker in the crosshairs of the feds. Let's go on to actually the mayor again, because you had an interview with him, Quinn, and this is something where he brought up, and I want to know if you think he's spitballing or serious, that New York has implemented this congestion tax that means cars are paying $9 or so to get into Manhattan, and the mayor says...
Well, to be fair, I brought it up and he answered the question.
Okay.
So, you know, New York, of course, a week ago instituted congestion pricing on a part of downtown Manhattan to basically reduce traffic and bring in more money for, you know, the MTA. I asked the mayor if something might work like that might work here in Chicago. He said we should definitely have the conversation, a robust conversation, and that we should explore it. He did not give a hard yes or no. So he seems like he is open to something like in the loop. Maybe there's some kind of way to tax drivers. As he kind of hinted that, especially maybe drivers who don't live in Chicago. I don't know if that's possible to differentiate exactly. So it is possibly on the table, and this does come. A recent study found Chicago, the average Chicagoan in 2024 spent over 100 hours sitting in traffic, and we are tied for worst traffic in the country with New York City. Second in the world, apparently, only to Istanbul, Turkey. So it is a huge problem. I do think a big part of that has been all the, you know, the slowdowns on the Kennedy. Of course, they've been doing work seemingly forever on the Kennedy. So maybe that'll change a little bit once that work finally does.
Yeah, I
does
wish
finish.
That I couldn't relate to that and say that that's outside my experience, but nope. Nope. Also, we have Roseland has a new health hub with his Johnson really following through on one of his promises to reopen closed mental health clinics. The total now is 3. Michael, why is this significant?
It's significant because of thinking back to Rahm Emanuel and the clinics that closed in his mayorship, and really Chicago trying to come back from that as far as the robustness of mental health offerings to citizens across the city. And Rosanna Rodriguez really taking this under her mantle and leading the charge when it comes to treatment, not trauma, to both reopen clinics as well as have mental health professionals come out instead of police for mental health crises. And last fall, I was at the Treatment Not Trauma Summit. I got to speak to the alderwoman about this, and the Roseland Clinic was one of the crowning achievements that she was really excited to see come forward. So this is great momentum for them, especially throughout the state of the budget for the city, for this still to be able to happen, and looking forward to seeing with this next fiscal year if they're able to keep that momentum when it comes to these budget woes that the city's facing.
But it's not like they, sorry to interrupt.
Please go ahead.
It's not like they didn't have mental health clinics in Lori Lightfoot's administration. They were just being overseen by private and nonprofit agencies, and now the mayor just wants to shift it to be city run back to the way it was with Rome.
Right.
Yeah. It is something that's lost in the narrative, I think, often, but such is politics, right? That's how you make the argument.
Right.
I think what's even more interesting is the care response, the non-police response to mental health crisis calls. This was kind of a fundamental part of the whole defund the police movement, which Brandon Johnson, you know, had distanced himself from. Sending mental health professionals to calls where a police officer doesn't necessarily need to be there, but someone needs a therapist or someone who can kind of help them work through whatever they're going through, that is being expanded, and I do think has been a huge focus of the mayor.
And there's now a citywide team as well.
I believe they're being expanded to 6 police districts. It's still not totally citywide, but it is expanding.
Awesome. Ray, let's go to you because speaking of Johnson, there's a revelation, including some Trib reporting here, that he's mayor, yes, but he could easily return to the classroom because since he left to be on leave as a teacher to join the CTU, he's still on leave.
Yeah, yeah.
So why might this present a conflict of interest? Does it?
Well, you would think it would. I mean, because he is basically putting himself in a position where he looks to be negotiating with himself in some way. If you're raising the salaries for teachers and you may go back to the classroom to get a teacher's salary, you may be talking about your own salary. And so,
or your pension bump at
the
end.
Or your pension bump, absolutely. So all of it rolls together. There's been questions, of course, since the campaign about how he's going to be able to handle all these different matters. And the conflict is just continuing to bubble up every day. It comes out when during the CTU talks. It comes out when he tried to force Pedro Martinez out. And it all has come to this rapid pace of what is going on here. And a lot of people would just like to see him say, yeah, I'm going to cut ties here, or yeah, I'm going to accept it the way it is, or I'm going to completely pull myself out of these talks.
Questions as well as to what action he took to clarify that there wasn't a conflict of interest. Does anybody say, no, this is fine. He's the mayor. We don't have to worry about
it. Well, the mayor does.
The mayor says it. And the reporting was that, hey, he did not go to the Board of Ethics to really ask them about that. But they said that they had an advisor, an ethics advisor, who said, okay, this was fine. Well, what about it? What can you give us more details? There's always a lot of detail that seems to be missing.
It's certainly an appearance of some kind of conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Whether it is one or not, there are people who can decide on that. Yeah. But if you're the mayor, wouldn't you want to kind of avoid an appearance of a conflict of interest and not have us talking about it right now?
Right.
The idea that it's not a conflict of interest, especially given with how much this has bubbled up. Where starting off the mayorship, before we knew that the CPS-CTU relationship and the fallout of this past year was going to be a defining thing, at least for this term for Johnson, that as this escalated, that would be something that's worth bringing up to someone that, hey, I am still affiliated with CPS and the CTU. I am technically on union leave. And yes, as this board that has just resigned, that I'm about to appoint to handle whether or not we're taking out a loan, the state of the pensions, that if I don't get reelected, I could go and make over $100,000 as a 20th year teacher.
With four years of classroom experience.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Questions are not going to be going away on this. Michael, as we round out the show, I want to land with you because the Cook County Medical Examiner says the lowest opioid overdose deaths in nearly a decade.
Right.
What's behind this sharp fall?
There's been a lot of advocacy work, Amanda, when it comes to overcoming the peak in overdose deaths, specifically when we think about the pandemic era, where right now for 2024, Cook County saw a little over 1,000 overdose deaths compared to 2 years ago, we were at 2,000. And so seeing this dramatic fall, where just from 2023 to 2024 is a 43% drop. And you have groups like the Westside Heroin Opioid Task Force who are out there in the streets, making sure people are aware of the dangers of opioids, as well as dispensing Narcan, Naloxone, Suboxone, that people can just take if should they experience overdose. Because when thinking about it and looking at the data, 87% of opioid overdose deaths involve fentanyl from 2024. And so that being a very real threat. And
we're going to have to end it there. But yes, a lot of efforts to get Narcan in the hands of people to try and save those who could be experiencing overdose. Good news to end the show on, that people's lives are being saved. So with that, our thanks to Ray Long, Shia Kapos, Michael Liptrot, and to Quinn Myers. We will be back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family. The Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by...
That is our show for this Friday night. Be sure to check out our website for the very latest information, including on how to cast your vote for a new Illinois state flag. That is at WTTW.com/news. Now for the Week in Review, I'm Amanda Vinicky. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe. Have fun playing in the snow and have a good night. All right, so the Chicago Bears, I'm not going to talk about their season, but Kevin Warren seems to think that the team is going to get a new stadium this calendar year.
I saw the three-paragraph article about that. I was like, this is just more bluster. Where's the money? They don't have the money.
A lot of dreaming going on.
Yeah, exactly.
The mayor referenced it, too. Where was he? He referenced...
Oh, I missed that one. But it does seem that the mayor is continually on board with keeping the Bears in the city. Where's the money?
But the mayor's not fronting the money.
Yeah. Well, you could
sell it for apartments and condos.
And make money, probably. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You do that and then use that money to pay for
it. But it is one of these things that I'm like, is this just wishful manifesting? Is that why you say it? Or does their lobbying team know something that I don't?
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports free educational initiatives in the legal profession.